Hey everyone, I'm Joel Hubbard. I'm an Enneagram coach here in the Boston area, and I'm thrilled to be talking to you.
Yeah, welcome to the Enneagram Panels podcast. We wanted to do something that was specifically based on Enneagram panels because what sets the Enneagram apart from other personality typing systems, and which are all very useful and very helpful tools, but there's something unique about it in the fact that it is based on self-reporting. It's not about an external box that we are trying to fit people into. It is a system that is based on what people report about themselves, about how they're motivated and how they function.
Yeah. And what you're going to hear as people begin to talk is you hear their diversity. You hear how they're not all uniform. It's as you hear a particular type, and one person might say, well, this is the way it shows up in my life. And someone else will say, well, it shows up this way. But what you definitely pick up on is the sort of unity around the motivation. There's a uniqueness about that. Even the feel in terms of their energy and how they think or feel about life is so remarkably similar. And I think that's why people, when they jump onto these panels themselves, say, oh my goodness, this has like been huge for me to talk to other people who think and feel very much at core the same as I do.
Yeah, and there's been something that has drawn us to the Enneagram. And I think that there's a couple main really good things that have come out of it. One has been, I haven't experienced a system that's better for self-work that actually helps people deal with their stuff personally. And the other huge benefit has been, it is an incredible tool for building empathy.
Absolutely. And when people get into this, they say to me things like, well, I already feel badly about myself, so why would I go looking for something that's going to make me feel worse? You know, like, I know I have to improve on all these things in my life. But to their surprise, they say, man, I can't believe that this thing, it's liberating. Like, it doesn't accuse me. I don't feel put down. There's so much grace in it. There's so much like, this is where you are. Begin where you are. You know, no shame, no guilt. But conversely, the other side, right? The other side says, I don't want something that tells me that this is just how I do things without really calling out my low side. Because I have an internal feeling, or it's pretty visible to me, that there's also a dark side to me. So it brings that to the surface. But like you said, what it does is it creates sort of a level of compassion that exists now in the room when people hear, this is what's driving you. I never knew that. I never knew it was underneath all of that. Sometimes husbands and wives who've been married for like 25 years, 30 years will say, I never even knew that that was really what was the whole thing behind you. And that brings out compassion in me. So I think that is a huge gift.
Yeah, it brings compassion. It brings healing. It brings empathy. That's been what we've seen even over the last several months and the last couple of years as delving into this. But it's interesting as we listen to the panels, a lot of them have a pretty deep understanding of the Enneagram, have been on that journey for a long while, have been looking at their own personal motivations, their own personal growth for quite a bit of time, and others that are brand new to it.
Yeah.
And in one of the episodes, it's actually a surprise because there's someone who found out shortly after that panel that they had the wrong one. And you can kind of tell they come from a different motivation as they're speaking on that panel,
right.
Which is fascinating. But I love how people really are vulnerable on this thing. Like, I think that's been the shocking thing in listening to them is how open and honest people have been about their own growth. Because not only do you have to be open, but you have to even be aware to be open.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's been this growing awareness within people. And this is something that's happening, I think, on a pretty widespread thing.
I agree.
This is a tool is really helping people do that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think I'm running into people today who are moving towards wanting to know, who am I? But not just who am I, but how do I change? How do I grow? There's a desire for that. And so this desire to be even authentic and vulnerable, I think it's all about like, I want to know who I am. I don't want this sort of hiding behind something or being blind. And I want to change. I want to grow.
Yeah.
But I don't want to grow based upon you putting something onto me and telling me this is what I have to do.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things that's interesting is how most of the models for growth or change is that it's sort of one model and one view. which undoubtedly comes from the particular type that is teaching that, you know. And so to understand there's a unique path for every single person. And that's so fun when you get into that and you show them and people start to see it. And then when they begin to move in that direction, this is what we're seeing on the panels. Are people talking about, you know, here's where I am, here's what's going on. And then you can see some of them have already begun doing some of that work and changing.
So many of them have had this moment, which is one of my favorite moments, where they realize something that their type does. And they say, oh, wait, you mean you all don't do that? Not everyone does this thing?
That is so, yeah.
It's absolutely fascinating. And I think that's one of the things that creates that empathy. But it also is just, it helps people wake up to themselves and patterns that they've been in for a lifetime that they didn't even realize. It's like that whole how do you tell a fish they're in water thing.
Right, right.
It's like it's, you just can't even see it. And all of a sudden this awareness like comes on.
Yeah.
So how we organize this podcast is we actually, the way the Enneagram teaches it is there's sort of centers. You have the body center, the heart center, and the head center. And so we organized it by that. And so we actually even asked you to listen in that order. So we start with the 8, 9, and 1, mm-hmm. which is the body triad. Then the 2, 3, and 4, which is the heart triad, and then the 5, 6, and 7, which is the head triad.
Yeah, and just so if you're brand new listening to this and you're going, what are these numbers, right? So part of it is we do give descriptors next to the numbers, and the Enneagram does this, but all of us who are teaching this stuff say the same thing, and that these numbers are our best attempt at giving descriptions about the type, right? They're not really the type, but we're trying. And the numbers really just sort of neutralize that. So let me just say that it is sort of a by the way. But that's what's really incredible is to watch how people from different centers, so people who are body center are people that are action-oriented, people that are heart-centered, people that are feeling-oriented, and people that are in the head triad are people that are head-oriented. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have all of them. We do. We have every one of them. It's just that we prefer one. One seems to be our go-to from which we see the world and how we process the world, right? So we go through that in that order, 8, 9, and 1, and you'll start to get that, and I hope you do, in as you're listening to this, you start to see a certain way of moving about the world. When you hear 8, 9s, and 1s, it primarily starts to be about action and motion or lack of motion, but you're not going to hear a whole lot of heart language, right? And then when you get to the 2, 3s, and 4s, oh my goodness, you hear heart language. And what was so funny was watching as people were saying things like what you said earlier, oh my goodness, I feel like I've fallen into a rabbit hole. Like what is, who are these? These are people like, they're aliens. They don't speak my, why do they not feel the way I feel, right? And so in an ordinary world, I think we just sort of marginalize those people like, oh, they don't really, I don't know what to do with them or they don't. But I think what this does is it sort of says there is this massive diversity in the world of how we see, how we feel, how we think. And the Enneagram says this is how we can see and understand what's going on behind the scenes. And so that's really fun. The whole head heart thing and body thing is really remarkably helpful.
I'm sure all of you out there have had the experience where someone does something and you just think to yourself, I would never do that.
Yeah.
I would never do it for those reasons. I can't relate to that at all. They must have a character issue. And sometimes it's just a perspective difference.
That's it, yeah.
Sometimes it's a character issue, but sometimes that has to be worked out. And if that person's doing their work, that's great. But sometimes it's not. So since we're just doing the overview, Joel gives a longer description at the beginning of each episode about the type we're talking to. But just briefly, we're going to go through the 9 types, just give a very short overview to kind of just let you step your foot into the water. And then as we go through this season, you'll get to know each type a lot more intimately. And that's the idea. We want everyone to get to know each of these unique types differently. And there's a wide diversity within each type. And, you know, each of us is an endless well. And so we want to help people become more curious about each other through getting to know each of these types.
Yeah. Yeah, I prefer the whole, even, you know, as we think about it, archetype versus stereotype. Because some of you are going to say, well, geez, I don't fit entirely into that description. Well, no one does.
Right.
No one does. So these are some of the characteristics we address that give us a sense of, yeah, I kind of relate more to that. And then as we get into it, we get more into the motivation, which then that's really where you either land or don't land.
Just note on that, I think about, you know, the scientist that said, all models are useful but wrong.
But they're all wrong, yeah.
Yeah, but they're, yeah. But this is the thing, is it's nothing is perfect, but this is an extremely helpful tool for personal development and empathy development. So yeah, let's just go through the types real quick, and we'll go through them in order like we do for the actual panels. So let's start with the eight.
Yeah, eights. I think we have an eight in the room.
This is true. I am an eight. But you'll give the description more succinctly than I
will. Yeah, yeah, exactly. When I get to the seven, I tend to get a little bit wordy because that's who I am. I'm a seven. So yeah, starting out with the eight. So this is the body triad. This is the action-oriented grouping, eight, nine, and one. Eights are protectors, particularly when they move towards their high side, their gifted side. There's the strength of who they are. They're very much about being strong. Eights moved away early on in life from the feeling of being vulnerable. The innocence was lost at an early age. Many describe having to sort of become the adult in the family, you know, rise up, be the protector, be the defender. They don't want life to do anything to them. They want to do everything to life. It's more of that stance of I'm prepared and I'm the asserter. I'm not in that receptive waiting kind of for life to do its thing. Eights are always in motion, physical motion. That's actually how they draw their energy is through being through doing, not through being, but through doing. And so eights repress anything that has to do with weakness and amp up the strength within them. And it shows up in various different ways. Sometimes it's physical strength. Sometimes it's more of a mental strength and in control through thought. But they do really lean into being strong, and that's a big thing for the eight. So eights tend to be intense, very intense people. Their vice, as it's sometimes called, is lust, meaning they'd go out at life with great gusto and great energy. You generally know when an eight is in the room because an eight has big personality, big, they're strong, they sort of put their presence, it just fills the room, right? So these are people that typically end up leading organizations, starting something, and that's a lot of the eight.
And they could not be more different than the next body type, which is the nine.
Yeah. Oh, man. The nine is the peacemaker. The nine early on sort of felt like their needs, their thoughts, their feelings were just not as important as those around them. They probably had more assertive types in their family. Almost anybody around a nine is more assertive than the nine. The nine would just sort of fade back, not share their thoughts, not share their feelings. They process much slower in terms of what do I think, what do I feel. But on the other hand, I think, and this is something that I don't think I've ever heard them say, but I think they process quickly what's going on in the world around them. They pick up on that much faster than almost any other type. They pick up the feeling, the atmosphere, the agendas that other people have, and then they merge. They lose themselves and they merge with the agendas of other people. And that's why they can see everybody's viewpoint and bring peace to a group. But they themselves have forgotten who they are. And so that's why we call that one of the vices. Is sloth. It's not my favorite word, but many of them say it actually works because even if they're super active, super busy, they know that the sloth has to do with they are not following their own priorities, their own desires. They're sort of forgetting about those things. And if they creep up, they just repress them. And so the nine falls asleep to itself.
But then they wake up to themselves when they move toward right action.
Correct, yeah. And that's where they go towards health. And they start to realize, I do have a thought about this. I do have a feeling about this. I do want to do something significant with my life. And there's also a longing to really be seen, to be affirmed, to be somebody. And so when they start to really wake up to that desire, they move towards right action and get things done. And when I know nines at, man, you wouldn't know that that's their vice. Their tendency is to go to a sloth because they're very active and very involved in the things that they love and want to do.
So that is also extremely different than the one.
Yeah. Oh, man, the one. They're called reformers. I love that positive term because the downside or the low side is really the perfectionist. And when I say that word, a lot of ones, if I'm trying to figure out who you are and I'm kind of throwing some stuff out there, when I say perfectionist, almost all ones that I've met start to shake their head up and down. Yep, that's what I battle. I battle with that. On the high side, I want to reform systems. Ones early on figured out that being good, I mean, it was just sort of innate within them. They wanted to be good people. They're the good boy, the good girl, the one that works super hard, the one that cannot make something good enough. It can always be done better. And so they're the student that that the teachers love. They get their work done. However, they're motivated by this sort of internal morality. Like it's really something deep within them. And so they really have a hard time calling something good enough. You know, it's never good enough. It can be made better. And so that drive towards perfectionism is driven by this sort of inner critic. Almost all ones I've ever met say the same thing. Yes. As soon as I say inner critic, other types will go, I don't know what that is, right? Give me a definition. Ones will say, oh, yes, I'm always hearing that voice of this should have been done that way. That person's tie is crooked. It's driving me crazy. That person's speeding on the highway. They shouldn't be speeding. So they tend to be black and white thinkers, rules oriented. That gets them into motion. That gets them into action. Gray is really difficult to deal with. If you look at a one, there's very little emotion around them. They're not angry. They're not deeply sad, or it's just really almost no affect to them. They're very even keeled. And it's part of their repression of anything that could be seen as bad or could get them into trouble or is just not good enough in their own minds. So they repress all of these instincts, emotions, and desires. So when the one starts to fall apart, the one really moves towards peace. And that's their desire, is to really get to the place of peace, serenity. So each type in that body triad is very different from the other.
Yeah, and the eight, nines, and one is also called that. At the core, there's anger that's pulsing underneath it. The eight is the most expressive and aware of that. The nine represses it, and then the one denies it. But they all have sort of that anger at the core, which is very different than the heart triad, which has more of a sadness or called a shame,
yes,
or at the core, which is the 2, 3, and 4, which is the heart triad. So yeah. Talk about the two.
Yeah, man, oh man. I mean, I see that over and over again with the 2, 3s, and 4s that I coach, is if they slow down enough, there's this sadness that creeps in, this shame about who they are. They're also called the image triad. So they have this additional description about them that's been very helpful to the 2, 3s, and 4s because they know that much of their identity is shaped by the world around them. That's unique with the 2, 3s, and 4s. It's very much about how you see me for different reasons for the 2, and the 3, and the 4. But that reason alone is why they then start to feel the sadness and shame creep up because they don't know who they are on the inside. They already feel like there's something defective, broken with them, something incomplete, something undesirable. And so the 2 is the helper. The 2 is the one that says, well, in order for you to love me, to accept me, in order for me to enter into relationship with you, I must help you. That's my way in. You need to see me as a helper. It's also part of their wonderfully gifted side, is they are naturally that way. They're excellent at being able to scan. In fact, their attention always goes out. It's never inward. It's who needs what out there? Who do I need to serve? Who do I need to take care of? And it's not indiscriminate, but they generally just love to help people. But they tend to look towards people that can help them feel better about who they are. If the person that they're helping says, hey, thank you so much, you've been very helpful, that's food to the soul for the 2. 2 needs to know, am I seen by you? Do you value me? But really, do you value my help? What's underneath is, I want to be valued, but I only know how to be valued and loved by what I do for you in service. And so the 2 represses its own needs, forgets its own needs. And that would be shameful for the 2 to have needs, to express needs. It's something they don't like within themselves. And so they go serve other people and do great at it.
which is so different from the three.
Yeah, I mean, this is what's funny is that there's such a similarity in that the three also feels like I need to be seen by the world around me. I also have this sadness that'll creep up if I slow down. But the three is a machine. These people are they'll conquer the world, man. They are goal-driven. They're called the performer because they are so ready to perform at any moment. They think in terms of goals. They think in terms of action. It's always action, action, action. But threes are trying to do that or really try to succeed or even have the image of success. I said this to 1-3 and just about fell over laughing. But I said, you know, you guys are going to try to succeed at all costs or at least spin it in a way that makes you look like you're succeeding. And he fell out of his seat. He was laughing so hard. Yep, that's what I do. That's what I do. If I fail, I'm gonna spin it because I need you to see me as successful. Because if you don't, then what? And when they do their inner work, they start really taking time to think about that and reflect what's driving them. It's really the sense of I need to feel worthwhile. I need to feel like you value me, you see me as worthwhile. If you don't, then who am I, right? And so the three itself, even though it's driven, goal-driven, accomplishment-driven, oftentimes will achieve at things that's not even really who they are. It's not even really what they want. And so they really have to work on truth, veracity. Who are you really? And what is it that you really want to do in life? And that's living from your own truth rather than from I need the affirmation so bad, I'll take whatever comes my way and succeed at it just to get that affirmation and to feel good about myself.
Yeah, and they are incredibly successful. They are incredibly driven. They have an incredible gift towards prioritization, which makes them very efficient. But I was talking to one recently who talked about, you know, for being in the heart triad, they're the least aware of their emotions. And one of them just recently said to me, I actually don't look at a lot of my emotions, especially the darker ones, because I'm afraid if I went into it, I'd never come out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I get that. I get that a lot from some of my clients. They just don't see emotions as efficient, as helpful in any respect. And then couple that with the fear of if I go there, then what? What will happen? Right. So I'm glad you said that about the threes because they're called the anchor point. So with each one of them, the triads, there's an anchor point, 8, 9s, and 1s. Nines have a sense of anger that lives within them. And as you said, Jim, nines are asleep to that. Nines don't see that, right? Action triad, right? It's action first. And yet nines can really fall asleep to action, right action in their lives. Threes are the anchor point, 2, 3, and 4 of the heart triads. And twos are aware of everybody's emotions. I should have said that earlier. I don't think I said that about the twos, but that they read emotions. That's what they're reading. And how do I help you, particularly in the emotional realm? And threes are also doing that. They're reading the emotions of the world around them, but it's in order to adapt. You know, who do I need to be in order to succeed? And many threes I talk to, it takes them a while. It takes them sometimes years. But they're starting to cue into, I think I'm being manipulated many times because I pick up on the emotions around me and I immediately go into action. I know exactly what to do. And so I solve the problem, right? Part of it for the three is becoming aware of their own emotional space and not just being in reaction to the emotions of the world around them in order, again, to feel successful, to feel valued.
Which is totally different from the most emotionally aware type on the Enneagram, the four.
Yeah, the four definitely is. The four sees themselves and oftentimes knows what it is feeling at any given moment. Even the fours that haven't done much work on their inner life do report that there's a sense of, I do feel like I have a lot of emotions throughout the day. I feel like I have a range of them, you know. But most fours will say, I even know how to articulate what's going on inside of me at any given time. So you ask a four how you're feeling, a four knows the answer to that question. So yeah, they're very self-aware. They're also aware of what's going on where they pick up on vibes around them, the energy, mostly the emotional energy of the world around them. So they're reading as well. 2, 3s, and 4s, again, they're reading the world of emotions around them. Unlike the two that is completely unaware of what's going on inside them for the most part until they begin doing their work. And 3s, same thing. the four has that capacity of knowing both what's going on around me and also what's going on inside of me. So it's a unique gifting that they have. I think fours are a therapist's favorite client. Because, you know, you come in, therapists will typically want to know, you know, what's going on. Who are you? You know, do you know yourself? Have you done any sort of work on yourself? Do you know what's your emotions? How do you feel? What's making it? And fours, man, they just, that's the question they live with. I mean, they're always in that space of, I know what's going on internally. Well, for the four, it's because early on, the four felt like something is broken with me, something, I'm defective in some way. I'm missing something, right? So the four then goes out searching for the missing self or the missing love. If I have it, I will be complete. If I find the missing self, I'll be complete. If I find the missing person, I'll be complete. If I fix myself, I'll finally be whole enough to be loved, right? I'm the one who stands outside the crowd looking in. I don't quite belong. I don't quite fit. And at the same time, there's a need to really a desire to be unique, to be different, to stand out. Other fours have told me, yeah, I do want to stand out in some way, but like I also, particularly the introverted ones, I don't want to like, you know, be crazy. but I do struggle with this sense of I don't quite fit in. And yet authenticity is so important to me as a path to really discovering the true self. They compare themselves oftentimes to people around them that seem to have more joy, something better, something they're just freer. And so the four always compares themselves to everyone around them. And they have this also this criticism that works hard on them, different than the one, but they have it in them. And for them, things are just it's just not quite there yet. There's something missing. I still need to do more. I got to get it. And oftentimes they get caught between the heart, the emotion, and then the narrative they tell themselves about what's going on inside them. And so for the four, it takes a lot of work for them to get out of that space and then get into action. And that actually is what helps the four to break free. And they call that equanimity when they finally get to that place of sort of I'm in motion, I'm doing the things that that I need to be doing. Because they're made to create beauty. Fours are some of the most incredibly gifted people at this space of beauty and creativity. And in regardless of what realm they work in, it doesn't matter where they are, they can create beauty in that space. And when they begin to move in that space of just saying, okay, I'm just going to put it out there. I'm just going to get in motion and do it and not overthink it and not get stuck in that it's not perfect enough or good enough and they just do it, man, what an impact they have on the world around them. And also hugely, you know, hugely compassionate people when they're around, you know, seriously broken people, hurting people. They have a well of compassion for that.
Yeah. So let's turn the corner to the last, the head triad, often referred to as the fear triad,
yeah,
which starts with the five, six, yeah, and seven.
Yeah, fives are those that they're called the observer. They're the ones that prefer to observe and do this really well. I mean, they observe the world around them. Before they engage, it's a way of collecting enough information, data, before they feel like I can finally get into it and engage in the world around me. Fives felt early on that there was not enough energy to let people into their world. Many of them felt like they weren't nurtured early on in life, or they had a parent that seemed to want to be in their space all the time. And fives oftentimes are introverts, and they really desire to take their time dealing with their emotional space. So they're the ones that really go to that head leaving the heart in the sense it's not that they don't feel, but that the automatic pattern is to block what they're feeling and to ascend to the safe places, which is their thoughts, their concepts, their imaginations. And that's what gives them a sense of being prepared for the world. Many of them love being a resource. The worst thing for them is when they're unprepared to be, when they feel like their information or the things that they gave to the world was wrong, was insufficient, was incorrect. So there's a huge importance they put on their thoughts, their imaginations, and that's where they live oftentimes. And so for fives, the world seems to be very demanding. There's a lot of invasion in the area of privacy. Fives love privacy. This is how they manage their world. Home life is home life. Work life's work life. My play life or my adventures are my adventures. This is part of managing the energy, managing the expectations in order to always be prepared in the headspace for whatever might, you know, come their way.
So after the five, you have the six.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sixes, there are a lot of sixes. Many Enneagram teachers say that really it's like between the six and the nine make up the most in the world, in America. Some say sixes are the most dominant in America. I didn't say this about the five, but fives love research. And I did say knowledge, but research is a big deal. For sixes, they too love knowledge, research, information, that sort of thing. But it really has to do with being prepared because the world is unsafe. That's their starting point. The world is unsafe, and I have to be prepared. So if I ferret out what's unsafe, then I can have plans around that. So their automatic attention goes right to what could go wrong in any given situation. That's the negative or the low side, right? But the thing is that what's remarkable about them is they actually do create a safer world. Without sixes, there'd be a lot more accidents. There'd be a lot more unforeseen to those of us who just don't see things in the same way. Mistakes made and disasters. Sixes think, I could give you a list right now of 10 things that could go wrong from the time I walk out of this room to the time I get to my car, right? So preparation is everything for the six. I need to have plan A, B, C, D, E, F, and G in place before I get going. All right. So for sixes in the business world who make up a lot of the, you know, sort of middle management and people that work in industries that really allow them to put their strengths out there, which is, again, being prepared, watching out for dangers, those things they do super well. But when the six starts to become healthy, they start to move towards faith that the world is okay, that they don't have to be that hypervigilant. And yet, surprisingly, they will still always be. It's not about don't be careful. It's about understand that your sense of fear is internal more than it is external. And when you understand that, then you can be a little bit more thoughtful. And sixes are not just bubble bursters or rain on your parade type people. They feel that way to types that, like mine, like my type, tends to think more positive initially. They start more at the downside, but sixes have definitely the capacity to get to understanding. They do understand the big vision. That's where they just start. And we need to know that about sixes so that we don't just, you know, shut them out because they're not jumping with us when we say, hey, let's jump, let's run, let's go do this thing. So sixes are a wonderful gift, I think, to the world as well.
Since they primarily fall into two categories, just briefly talk about the difference between the phobic six and the counterphobic six.
Yeah, counterphobic sixes are a rare bunch. There's not as many of them, but counterphobic sixes don't look like your typical six because they're the ones who seem assertive, aggressive, go at life. In fact, they oftentimes get confused with, as we talked about earlier, the eight, because they tend to go at life first before life gets at them. But one of the counterphobic types that I know very, very well is one who says, I am fearful. I am hypervigilant. I do have these things going on. And so I relate with the sixes, definitely. How I go about life, though, is in reaction to that, is different than a lot of the sixes because I feel like I got to go at it. You know, I got to go at the fear rather than run from it. That's how I conquer it. That's why I think I'm going to conquer it, right? But it never actually works. So, because there's always another one to come up with. There's always another possible disaster that could come our way. So this six will say, well, I attack first. I go at it first. I face it head on. And that's how I deal with it. They're the ones that will jump out of a plane. They're the ones who will do some of the craziest things, you know, in order to face their fears.
But the phobic?
The phobic runs from it. They do the opposite. So now this is, again, these are extremes how we talk about this. So we're putting in these polar opposites. Many of them will report, I tend to live out of the phobic, but occasionally I go counterphobic. And counterphobics say, I generally live in the counterphobic, but occasionally I go in the phobic. Meaning, at times, I amp up and go at something if I'm phobic and face my fears. I go counterphobic. And if I'm counterphobic, sometimes I'm too scared. I'm running from this one. And it's not necessarily running, but it's, I'm going to do my best to avoid it, or I'm going to work really hard to solve every possible worst case scenario and have a plan before I finally get into motion, you know, and that's typical of the phobic six.
All right. Close with the seven.
Yes. The seven. Yeah. So this is my space. And I think, again, one of the wonderful things about the Enneagram is that it's really about self-reporting. So not all sevens, not all sixes, not all fives, they don't all feel the same or behave the same way. But at core for the seven, there's a need to avoid pain. There's a need to nurture, to feel nurtured, to go after something that will fill that sense of emptiness, that sense of I'm running out of something. And so the seven tends to go at it, again, in the headspace, go towards the thing that they feel will be fun, exciting, life-giving. So a new idea. Sevens will go chasing. They're called the monkey minds. You know, they just, everything is about whatever new distraction, whatever new fun thing can come along, the seven jumps onto it. And the reason why I started off by saying not all sevens are alike is because there's some parts of it, like the party animal. Sevens are typically the ones that are the first on the dance floor, the last to leave the party. And people who know me would say, well, that's not entirely you. And my own wife said that. You're not entirely that. But in respect to the need to be distracted, to have fun, to always chase something, to run from difficulty and pain, things I can't fix, things I can't resolve, that living with a regular anxiety, and by the way, all head types deal with that because we're in our head. We live in our heads. Anxiety is there, a regular constant theme. The sevens oftentimes don't notice the anxiety. They just see it as hyperactivity or energy. And what's functioning underneath is that need to consume, the need to run from things that will take from you so that you can go get something that will give to you. So their vice is called gluttony. And as the seven moves towards health, the seven finally says, okay, I don't need all of these things. Everything I have or I need is right here in the present. And when the seven does that, the seven slows down and begins to actually finish their work, finish their projects, self-limit. No, I'm not taking on this new thing. No, I'm not going to chase this new idea. I'm going to self-limit right here. And that's a huge indication of health for the seven, who typically hates and fears confinement and limitations. So that's the seven.
Yeah, so that's the intro to all of the types. Hopefully that gives you a good, you know, sort of 30,000-foot view of the overview of the types before delving deeper into each type and really hearing from them themselves, I think, because that's the best thing. Hearing descriptions can kind of help you get an overview, get a general idea. But because people are complex, they are nuanced, they are incredible. Every person is this eternally deep well, and they are also unique. So it really helps to hear people talk about their specific journey. And, you know, hearing the overview, you get a concept, but it's so neat when you hear that concept embodied in people telling their own stories about what it's like to live in their skin. So we really hope you enjoy this time and you really learn a lot from it. And you're really benefited by hearing from all the different types. So thank you for listening to the Enneagram Panels podcast, brought to you by Talkie Records and Vine 39 Church in Stoneham, Massachusetts. To find out more about Enneagram coaching from Joel, you can go to www.joelhubbard.com.